Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Popcorn Science. In this podcast, we take a critical look at the science portrayed in our favorite movies and television shows. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Catherine Nisch. I'm a professor of earth sciences, a planetary geologist, and a fan of pop culture.
And I'm John Moores. I'm a professor at York University, a space engineer, a planetary scientist, and a speculative fiction nerd.
Okay, so this week I got to pick the topic, and we hadn't done a television show in a while, so I decided to go back to my roots and pick one of my favorites. This week we're covering Battlestar Galactica, the rebooted miniseries from 2003. This was the backdoor pilot to the show that then went on to cover four seasons. But we're not going to talk about that, although I might accidentally spoil John here because he hasn't seen the show before. We're mostly going to focus on the miniseries, but there might be something from the rest of the series that spills over into our conversation. So spoilers ahead, be warned. So this miniseries, in this universe, there are humans that live in the 12 colonies of Kobol. And at some point in the past, we don't know exactly when, they developed a race of robots they call Cylons. The Cylons gained sentience and rose up against their masters, and they had a huge war between the humans and the Cylons. Now, this miniseries is set 40 years after that war, when the Cylons return to try to destroy their creators. And this time, unlike the metallic robots they look like in the past, there is a new type of Cylon that looks human, making it easy for them to hide amongst the survivors of humanity.
Now you're telling me you're a machine.
I'm a woman.
You're a machine woman. You're a synthetic woman. A robot.
I've said it three times now.
Well, forgive me, I'm having the tiniest little bit of trouble believing that, because the last time anybody saw the Cylons, they looked more like walking chrome toasters.
And after the Cylons wipe out most of humanity, a ragtag crew of humans flee the 12 colonies, protected by the namesake, the Battlestar Galactica, and her crew. The remaining humans band together to find a new home, a mythical place known as Earth. So I, as I mentioned, am a big fan of Battlestar Galactica. I didn't watch it right from the beginning, but I watched it about, I would say, halfway through when I was in graduate school. So probably from about season three onwards, I watched it live. I didn't have cable, so I'd go over to a friend's house, we'd watch it together, and then I caught up on the shows I had missed, and yeah, really fell in love with the characters and the story, and yeah, this was a big part of my grad school career. I was telling John I actually dressed up as Six, Caprica Six, the Cylon woman for Halloween in 2008, so yeah, this is a big part of my evolution as a human. But John, it sounds like you've never seen it before.
I think this is possibly the title about which we have the most difference. Like, not only had I not seen it before, other than I was aware that there was a TV show called Battlestar Galactica, I didn't know when it took place, anything about it, whether it was something that was old or new. And of course, in research, I've discovered it is both old and new. So it's interesting that way. This was my first exposure to it. So unlike the core, where the reputation preceded it, here, I had no idea other than Catherine talking about how awesome it is. And we were recently at a conference where other people chimed in with it being awesome as well. So, you know, my hopes were high for this one.
Yeah, I'm surprised you never saw it. Did you know what a Cylon was? Had you ever heard that term?
I think I might have heard the term, but I was really unaware on this one, I have to say. This was well outside of my science fiction experience. So thank you for suggesting, you know, one of the planks of 21st century sci-fi.
I do think it's important. Yeah, it sounds like we have different opinions about the show, and that might be as a result of how we watched it or how much of it we've watched. So it'll be interesting to talk about that. I will note, I have not seen the original 1978 version, although some of those actors do come back and are part of the show in the reboot. So that's kind of fun to see them interact with their counterparts in the new show.
Yeah, it was interesting to have that kind of crossover. I think that adds a little bit of an element to the people who'd seen it before. But why don't we just get into this? Because I was taking a look at the list of science gripes. I think you might have one or two here.
Yeah, so, I mean, I enjoyed the show when I watched it. And I honestly did have science gripes even when I was watching it live. But I hadn't focused this intently on it. So it was fun to dive into this. And where should we start, John? What's your favorite topic in this list?
Oh, the octagonal paper. That is just so aggravating.
Yeah, there are some stylistic choices they make in order to make, I think, this world look a little bit more alien. And one of them is all of the papers have their corners clipped off, and photographs have their corners clipped off, books have their corners clipped off. I don't know why anyone would do this. Right? It's super inefficient. Is there some guy whose job it is to just sit there with rectangular pieces of paper and clip all the edges off? Like, why would you make an octagonal piece of paper? It does seem rather bizarre. But stylistically, it's an interesting choice.
It is interesting to watch the actors actually deal with having these octagonal pieces of paper. At least in the miniseries, you can tell that there's some of them, Balthazar, for instance, who is really having a hard time turning pages.
Oh, Baltar, you mean?
Baltar,
I think it's fun that you called him Balthazar, though. Yeah, yeah. Or you can see, like, you remember those old, you know, printers you'd have in like the 80s and 90s, the dot matrix printers that would come out. So they had some of those on the Battlestar Galactica, and it spit it out, and they also had no corners. So where were the corners going? I don't know. It's so bizarre that they would do it this way.
I think it's a part of the whole idea of this ship as essentially a Luddite ship in a way, because when I first saw all this paper and the corded phones and whatnot, it's like, did someone take like a nuclear submarine and put it in space or something like that? And it did confuse me for a while until I realized they out and say that, well, the big advantage of the Battlestar Galactica is that its computers are not networked together and it's using really low tech stuff so the Cylons can't infiltrate it. And I can tell you that I don't know a single military that takes this particular tack. And I feel like you're giving up a big advantage to the Cylons here in that they can coordinate themselves and they can run the newest tech and whatnot. And you're stuck with this steam-powered ship. I know it's not really steam-powered, but it kind of feels like intentionally low tech.
Well, and I think, again, that was a stylistic choice. I think they wanted the Battlestar Galactica to look like an old submarine, have that sort of gritty experience while we were watching it. But yeah, I was surprised that you thought this was not a good idea. Like, how else would you avoid a Cylon attack if not for what they did?
Well, I mean, the way that it's typically handled, this is why you have, you know, signals, electronic and cyber warfare, right? Trying to interdict what's being done by the others. But I kind of feel like if you just say, okay, we're just going to use, you know, ancient technology here and let our enemy use the newest and latest and greatest, that I kind of feel like that's why they lost in part.
Well, yeah, they also weren't as motivated as these Cylons. They really wanted to kill people. And speaking of which, I was curious as to the method they chose to kill everyone, which appeared to be nuclear bombs. So I dug into this a little bit more. Like, how easy would it be to kill everyone on Earth with a nuclear bomb? And it was actually harder than you would nominally think. So I started looking up, like, how many people does a nuclear bomb kill? And fortunately, or unfortunately, we've only had two instances on Earth where they purposely bombed a city in order to kill people. And those were, of course, at the end of World War II, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And from what I could find, the estimate was that those killed about 200,000 people total, although that was a relatively small bomb, 20 kiloton bomb. So you could say, okay, well, if every bomb kills 100,000 people, then you'd need 80,000 bombs to kill 8 billion people. That's a lot of bombs. But as John pointed out, they specifically referenced in the show, they were using much larger bombs, 50 megaton bombs. And there was one of those bombs constructed on Earth by the Russians, the Tsar Bomba, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And there's actually a really fun, well, fun in quotey marks, website you can go to simulate a nuclear bomb blast over your favorite city. So I did it over Toronto. You know, as we talked about during the core, it's always good to avoid large city centers if you're in a disaster movie. And it estimated that a big bomb could kill about 2 million people with maybe another 1.5 million injuries. So that's a lot of people. But if you were in a denser population center like London, England, you could kill perhaps as many as 5 million people. So it really depends on how many large cities you have. And we don't know the geography of Caprica and the other colonies very well. So it's unclear how many major population centers they have. But if they're like Earth, I actually looked it up, and there's about 4,000 cities on Earth with populations over 100,000 people. So let's say you have 4,000 bombs that would kill everyone in those cities. So I went well into the weeds here, and I actually found a population survey of everyone on Earth. I think it was put together by the UN. And so I added up the population of these 4,000 cities, and it's only about 2 billion people out of the present population of 8 billion. So there's a lot of people on Earth who are sort of spread out amongst the hinterlands, I think, as John referred to them as. So obviously radiation from 4,000 nuclear bombs would take quite a toll on everyone. But could you really kill everyone, even if you had 4,000 50 megaton bombs? I'm not convinced you can.
Always hard to, you know, do that. But like, luckily, the Cylons are really obsessed with mopping up. So they're not going to let nuclear winter take care of it. It is interesting, though, there was in fairly recently declassified records a project during the Cold War to actually create a nuclear weapon big enough that it would cause a nuclear winter and essentially end civilization. It's interesting where people's, well, I don't know if interesting is the right word, but people's minds definitely go to, you know, how do we get rid of an entire civilization a little bit. So if you want to wait for the environment to take some time, you can do better than just knocking everybody out individually.
Yeah, maybe the Cylons went around and like killed people with guns, the rest of the people who were left over. When we do eventually return to Caprica later on in the series, and it looks pretty deserted. We do find a couple of survivors, but there aren't a ton of people there. It is very radiation heavy. Like one of the characters has to constantly take radiation meds in order to prevent him from getting sick. But yeah, I don't know how they went around killing those other 6 billion people other than a lot of Cylons with guns. I don't know.
Weren't they chasing one of the characters who stayed behind on Caprica in the miniseries? I think that was there towards the end of it.
Oh, that definitely comes up later in season one. Don't know if it's in the miniseries, but yeah, that's Hilo. Hilo stays behind on Caprica and is constantly being hunted by the Cylons, essentially. But he doesn't see a lot of people when he's running around what used to be a pretty heavily populated city. So the other thing I thought was interesting that I hadn't really paid too much attention to before was the solar system that the 12 colonies of Kobol occupy. And I guess they try to do this a couple of different ways. They're like, oh, the 12 colonies could be 12 cities on a single planet. But in the end, they decided to have them be 12 separate habitable worlds, which is really hard to explain. You know, in our own solar system, we have one, maybe two habitable worlds. There's a very famous exoplanet called TRAPPIST-1 that has a ton of Earth-sized planets, 7 nominally Earth-sized planets, but only 3 of these are in the habitable zone. So how in the world would you get 12 planets in a solar system? And I looked it up, and I guess the common wisdom is that the Battlestar Galactica solar system actually has 4 stars, so 2 binaries orbiting each other, and that some of the planets share orbits with each other. So they're really cramming them in here in this very bizarre solar system. So it's not impossible. It's just extremely rare. And I don't know how they found this solar system and decided to settle it this way. I don't know. What are your thoughts on this, John?
It's so weird. I mean, you think stuffing even more stars in here would make things more painful as well, because then all the planets have to be further out to not be, you know, disrupted or disturbed too much by these stars. I was actually thinking after you mentioned this in the notes, you know, is there a way that you could do this? And of course, the cheating way is to make them all moons of a gas giant.
Right.
Because then they're all in the same orbit. And you can slightly uncheat a little bit by putting them in the Trojan points. So the Trojans and the Greeks leading and trailing at 60 degrees along the orbit. So you can actually put a couple of planets in there as well. But yeah, 12 planets in the habitable zone of 4 stars. Ouch. I don't know. Maybe this is a technosignature of something that came before to have such a weird system.
Yeah. Although I thought, oh, star systems can't have 4 stars. But I actually looked it up and there is one star system they've found that has 7 stars in it. So it's rare, but it's not impossible. So that was kind of a surprise to me. I had no idea there was a septuplet system out there. We're so used to having just the one star, the lonely star. So that seems pretty weird to me.
Must be something really big at the center of that. One of those stars must be truly enormous.
Yeah, if anyone wants to look it up, I think it's called New Scorpii. I don't know how to pronounce that. One of those constellations that were eventually named for the colonies. Okay, so what else? All right, so a big plot point in Battlestar Galactica is that the Cylons are able to download their memories into a new body. And you don't see much of it in the miniseries, but Caprica 6 does mention this to Baltar while he's freaking out when the nuclear bombs start going off. He's like, how are you getting out of here? How are you going to protect yourself? And it's implied that she's going to download her memories and, you know, come back in another body. So I was curious, how much memory you would need to upload your consciousness. And of course, there's a Reddit page on this if anyone's interested. Somebody did a back of the envelope calculation guesstimating that there's 100 trillion synapses in our brain. And so how many connections would that be? And worked it out to like 100 terabytes. So it's who knows, right? I was just looking for any number.
It's a good bit.
Any number to work with. So let's say, okay, 100 terabytes, that's your consciousness. You know, how long would that take? So if I was using my home internet speed, which is 1 gigabit per second, it would take 10 days. Now, presumably the Cylons have access to faster internet than my home internet. So, you know, if you had something like a business might use 100 gigabits per second, it would only take 2.5 hours. But the fastest internet speed ever recorded is 400 terabits per second. In a lab in Japan, I found an article about this, which is pretty fast. So maybe the Cylons just have super fast upload speeds and can do that 100 terabytes in the blink of an eye.
I can definitely believe fast upload speeds. Certainly, things have been getting faster and faster for us. I can imagine in the future in another civilization that happens. My beef with this one is about the infrastructure. You know, obviously, there's not a cable they're plugging into their head. And oftentimes, it seems they're talking about this in situations where there's not a lot of Cylon infrastructure around. So is this something that they're having to broadcast across solar systems, across, you know, stellar distances at these kind of speeds? I think that transmitter is hard.
Right. And so this is another spoiler for the audience and for John. So they do address this later in the series. It becomes a bit of a plot point. They have special ships called resurrection ships that always travel with the base stars. But if you're too far from a resurrection ship, yeah, you will not download and you will die. And so it becomes more of a, you know, a point of tension as the series progresses. Can the Cylons get back to their resurrection ship or not?
It's interesting to talk about it as death, right? Because there's this question of just because you've copied the information, does that mean that you have the actual consciousness of this creature? Now, with the Cylons, where they're, you know, mechanical androids, that sort of thing, you know, maybe it does. But we've got that question. We talked about it a little during, I think, the Tribbles episode. You know, when you use the transporter, is it you that's being transported? Or is a copy being created and then your consciousness is terminated? This kind of downloading of brains, I think, asks a lot of these same questions.
Right. And it makes it even more interesting because there's not just one copy of each of these Cylon models, right? Mm. They're essentially like, I was going to say twins, but there's more than twins, right? There's could be hundreds of these Cylon copies, right? And they all maybe started with the same sort of consciousness, but then as things progress, you know, things change and they become almost different people. And so now we've got multiple consciousness that you have to keep track of. And yeah, it's kind of interesting. Like, where does the original person start and how do they evolve over time? Are they the same person at the end of it? And further on in the series, the Cylon models start disagreeing with each other, even amongst their own model type. And it leads to some, you know, internal civil war, essentially, as they grow and develop.
That's the danger of getting organics into the mix.
Just sort of stuck with the toasters.
Exactly. Oh, goodness. Those scanny things that I'm guessing harken back to the 1970s. Like, okay, I got that on the initial robots, but the ships in space, those are pretty big. Those are using a lot of real estate just to, you know, have that malevolent back and forth, I have to say.
Yeah, so we learned that those are actually organic too, the Cylon Raiders.
Oh.
Yeah, they look metallic on the outside, but if you go inside, they're like the organic Cylons. There's a really cool episode where Starbuck has to learn how to operate one from the inside, and this is just covered in goo the whole time with all the organic parts around it. So so even those are part organic.
Well, I think before we move on, there's some other interesting things that I think you found here. I particularly like the bit about the museum pieces because, of course, in the miniseries, the Battlestar Galactica is already pretty much mocked up to become, you know, something that sits in a harbor or the equivalent.
Right. And not only the whole Battlestar itself, the Vipers too, that they have in a little museum set that I think takes up the entire portside landing strip, right? They're not able to use it because it's turned into a museum. So I was curious, you know, if you looked at aircraft in museums on Earth, could you like just take them out and fly them? And the answer seems a bit mixed. It seems for the most part, no, they're not really airworthy, especially if they're trying to preserve old parts and pieces from that era rather than the more modern era. But it seems like in most cases, they could be tweaked and improved in order to fly if you really needed them to. But it doesn't seem like it's a simple thing. They just like throw aside the markers, grab the Viper and fly it, right? But it seems like they would need quite a bit of restoration work before that was possible. So I didn't think that was particularly realistic, especially when they you know, made a big point that Adama's old Viper, the crew had spent, seemed like a long time to restore it. So while it's possible, I doubt that these Vipers were spaceworthy and could just have pilots hop in them and fly and fight the Cylons. They probably would have been stuck there for a couple of months tweaking the Vipers to have them flight worthy.
Oh yeah, and it'd be even worse for ships. I mean, I think the best you can assume here is that the Galactica is off being, you know, it's in the process of being decommissioned, and so it's still space worthy. But usually when you encounter these military vessels tied up at the harbor as museum pieces, often there's not even an engine in them anymore. They've removed anything of value from it. It is interesting, though entertaining, you know, what is it they say at one point? They're asking after something and they're like, it's a gift shop now.
Yeah. So. Well, it was the port, yeah, I think landing strip.
Yes.
Yeah. I still didn't understand, why do they pull in the landing pads when they jump to light speed? It doesn't make sense to me. I don't know. Did you have any thoughts?
Maybe there's some interior logic here. I mean, I don't know. Like, you know, Star Trek, you know, they can go to high speed with the nacelles out.
So. That's right. I don't know. It doesn't seem like it's important that they're in or out, but they do make this big point. Maybe it's just important for the plot, right? That they got to get everyone on board before they close down. So
more dramatic.
It is more dramatic. I'll give them that. Another thing that kind of bothers me and bothers me throughout the series is this whole idea of Caprica 6, the Cylon model that's entirely in Baltar's head. I might call her Head 6. That is what the lingo is. But she's not real as far as we can tell. She seems to be an imaginary version that only Baltar can see. And she tries to explain it to him that, oh, maybe she implanted a microchip in his brain so he could see her. But I don't know if that makes any sense. He seems too lucid for this to be a hallucination. You know, as the series progresses, I think they just sort of wave it off as sort of God's intervention than any scientific explanation. What did you think of this, John?
I mean, they're talking about creating Cylons and human bodies, and the bodies are more or less indistinguishable to the level of they perform an autopsy on one of them, and all of the same structures that we're used to are there. So if they have the ability to put that kind of wiring and chips and whatever compute power they need into that kind of a form factor, I wouldn't write it off that there could be something. I mean, I have to admit that when I was watching this, I had assumed, because they had that jump cut between when Baltar's house is destroyed and when we see him again, I figured that, you know, he had been turned into one of the Cylons wholesale. But I understand from you that that is not the case, or at least they never have a storyline that implies that.
Yeah, they sort of tease it throughout, but it doesn't seem like Baltar is a Cylon. It doesn't seem like his body was replaced. It was a subject of considerable argument, I would say, within the fan base. Like, because yeah, it seems like he should have been killed in that explosion, and so, you know, the reason he wasn't seemed like, oh, he's a Cylon, but he's not a Cylon, as far as we can tell. So I don't know what happened there. The other bizarre thing, though, because they do seem so human, but yet they have this weird quirk when they're at Ragnar Station that the radiation there seems to really affect them in a way it doesn't affect humans, which I thought was weird if they are so closely related to humans and their organic chemistry. And even for electronics, you know, so John and I work with spacecraft and, you know, it's very common to radiation harden the electronics in them so they aren't as affected by all the radiation you're exposed to in space. So, you know, it just seems like bad design on both ends of the spectrum here. The organics don't work, the electronics don't work. Why didn't they do a better job of protecting against this?
Yeah, it's the plot that requires it. That's all I can come up with, because really, while, you know, silicon does take damage from radiation, and we see that in our spacecraft as well, you'd expect that a human being would also take damage. Mm-hmm. So why do they have this space station that's full of radiation?
Yeah.
That would be bad for the people who were there. And also, why did the Cylons release, you know, in beta this organic version of themselves that couldn't take the radiation in space, of which there's a lot, not just on a munitions depot?
Well, and also the dead giveaway of the glowing spines when you have sex. Like, what the heck? I mean,
that was bizarre.
It's bizarre. It makes no sense. Why would that feature be there? It's a dead giveaway. The only reason they have it, I think, is to tell the viewer, oh, this person's a Cylon. But you could have done that in a lot of different ways. Right. I mean, obviously, they're trying to be like a sexy show or something. Certainly, it's more of an adult show than a kid's show. But yeah, it just doesn't make any sense from a scientific perspective.
Maybe they're just trying to show that Baltar is really, really not perceptive.
I mean, he's not, but he's, as you will see, he's not the only one who encounters this. So maybe all the men in the colonies are not very perceptive.
All right. Well, perhaps what we'll do is, though we could talk for hours, I'm sure, on the bits and pieces here, we'll take a short break and we'll come back with the Science Shine. Welcome back. There are things, I think, that Battlestar Galactica gets right. And this is the part of the program where we talk a little bit about that and where they've done some nice things. So was there one thing that really sort of stuck out to you as, you know, like, ooh, this makes sense?
I think just the look of it makes sense to me. So the look of the spacecraft and how they maneuver in space all seems relatively realistic to me now that I was watching the show with an eye to that. You know, the space station that we first encounter, it has solar panels, it has docking tubes, it has communication arrays. The shuttle that the ambassador takes there looks like a spacecraft. You know, we see Colonial One lifting off of Caprica, and the jets are going in the right direction. You know, so they seem to
take that Star Wars.
Take that Star Wars, yeah. They seem to maneuver in space correctly too. I love the Vipers. You can see all their maneuvering thrusters, and so they'll spit gas out and they'll go in different directions as you would in a real spacecraft. There's no banking turns like we see in Star Trek. So I thought the look of the spacecraft and how they maneuver in space was one of the more realistic aspects of the show.
And they are missing, I think, your favorite interior material for spacecraft, which is carpeting.
That's right. There's no carpeting. But that's probably more realistic. Right.
It's true. And then you get, you know, that clunking on the deck when you're running from one end of the Battlestar Galactica to the other because there is no way to help you cover the, what is it, kilometer and a half?
Well, yeah. So the show opens with Starbuck running around the Galactica, presumably for her exercise. And I was like, could you really run around a spaceship and get any exercise? So I looked it up, and the Battlestar Galactica is huge. It's meant to be about a kilometer and a half long. So for those nerds in the audience, that's about the size of an Imperial Star Destroyer. Much bigger than the Star Trek Enterprise. So that's pretty big. And even if you assume some of that is devoted to engines, maybe it gives you a kilometer of room to move around in. So she's got quite a bit of room to run around in. That actually surprised me. I thought I was going to look it up and it wouldn't make any sense. But I was reading up actually about submarines and battleships. And apparently, sailors do run around. Maybe not submarines, but battleships. They'll do several laps of the deck in order to get their run in. So this seems realistic.
And it's got that real heavy look, like you mentioned ships. And, you know, I can see it from aircraft carriers that I visited. And in fact, it looks like the transport for the president, once you go below decks, I swear that's a BC ferry. It looks just like it to me.
It could be. I've only been on a handful of BC ferries. As we'll talk about, this is filmed in Vancouver. So there's a lot of Vancouver hints throughout the show.
I think they also do the faster to light transition better than a lot of shows do. Like in some cases, you just see the spaceship speeding up or the stars start to streak. And there's this idea of really intense acceleration and speed that's going on. Whereas would that really happen in real life? I mean, with that faster than light technology, maybe you just pop out of existence in one place and pop in another place. Certainly the stars going by really, really fast. That doesn't seem like it makes sense in a relativistic sense in other shows, and they don't even bother with that here.
Yeah, I like that too. I also think they were trying to play a little bit with the length contraction you experience when you get nearer to light speed. As they make their first jump, Callie says, oh, I hate this part. And you can see the whole screen like contracting in on her. And this is something that is thought to happen when you approach the speed of light. It might have been actually measured. I didn't dig into this too much, but it's called Lorentz contraction. So it was named after the scientists who came up with it. And it would technically happen at any speed, but it's just not noticeable until you get very, very close to the speed of light that objects would contract in size and become shorter.
But definitely a fun way to use that forced perspective where you pull the camera back while at the same time as you're zooming in. It's a little bit fun and freaky.
It was. It was a cool effect. I will note that they almost never use that in the rest of the series. It was the only time they do it. So they just jump and then they're, as you say, they just appear somewhere else. So the other thing I kind of liked is sort of their discussions about what is life? Where did life come from? These ideas about, I hesitate to call it astrobiology, but because we think these are humans and Cylons were just robots mm-hmm. made by humans. But the very first words uttered in the miniseries are you alive? So Caprica 6 is asking this ambassador this question, which is kind of a, you know, kind of an interesting way to start a show about these robot people. Are they alive? What makes something alive? And it's not something that's easy to define. I spend the whole first week of my astrobiology class talking about it. And, you know, I've been doing this for years now, and I still don't have a good idea of how to define life. It's very difficult to define.
Yeah, it's a fascinating question, like you say, and you have to deal with a lot of counterexamples here. So even if you think you know, and you know, it's one of those things, you know it when you see it, you probably don't. I've been really interested to see some of the things going on here in terms of like information science lately to try and classify this, but there's still so much for us to learn. And that whole thing, by the way, with Battlestar Galactica about aliens and how it's handled, I thought was interesting. The idea that you have human beings who've gone out into the galaxy from somewhere and have, they found this weird bonanza star system, but they have faster than light transport. They can go to other star systems as well. There's no one there. There's no one home. The only two groups, and I think Catherine has assured me that more aliens don't show up.
Nope.
Yeah, so we have just human beings and then the creatures that human beings created. So, you know, this gets back, I don't know if they ever explored this, but this makes me think about like the Great Filter and all of that stuff. Whether this kind of sentient, you know, large scale intelligent life is abundant in the universe or not.
Yeah, they do go to several other planets and they find simple life forms. I actually love in the first season, they actually address where you're going to get water, where you're going to get food. And so they find like this algae planet where they're going to eat a bunch of algae, basically. So they find more simple life forms and habitable planets, but no other sentient beings that they encountered other than humans and Cylons. And it's interesting, too. I love the speech that Adama gives at the end, where he says, life here began out there, which is kind of a summary of the concept of panspermia, which is this idea that maybe life on Earth didn't develop here, it developed somewhere else, and then was transferred to Earth through an asteroid, comet, some interstellar object that came from the planet to here. So, you know, we could be Martians, right? Maybe life developed on Mars and was transferred here, and then we developed. So it's an idea people talk about. I think actually we touched on it maybe in our very first episode. It was touched on in the X-Files episode, Tunguska Terma. I don't love the idea of panspermia because it just like punts the question of how life originated to another planet that we know less well. But, you know, it's not impossible. And certainly in Battlestar Galactica, that seems to be their history, right? They came from Kobol to settle the 12 colonies. From Kobol, we don't know what happened before that, but it does seem like there's been some colonization of the universe in this series.
It is interesting. I do wonder how much of the history, and I guess I'll find out more as I see more of the show, how much of their history they're aware of. Because the longer you go back, the harder it is to keep records. I thought it was interesting looking at that scroll at the very end of the miniseries where they have that little sort of funereal type of ceremony. And just thinking about the kinds of religion that you'd wind up with in this kind of a setup. Although it kind of sounds like they hew awfully close to the ones we know.
Yeah, what's interesting about Battlestar Galactica is that they're primarily a polytheistic culture with many gods. And Caprica 6, Head 6, is kind of weird in that she only believes in one god. So she'll talk about God a lot, whereas the colonists talk mostly about the gods, Kobol. And so that's an interesting take they kind of take. Because on Earth, it's sort of the opposite, right? Most religions are monotheistic. Christianity and Islam are the two biggest religions on Earth, monotheistic. Hinduism has about 15%. That's the biggest polytheistic religion on Earth. So it's kind of interesting to see them take that different tack here. I also thought it was weird that they named all the colonies after the constellations. Caprica after Capricorn, Sagittarion after Sagittarius, Picon after Pisces, and so forth, which I actually came up with a really good backstory that they decided not to go with.
Do tell.
Well, I thought it would make sense if humanity originated on Earth, as we do, and then went and colonized Kobol at some point in the past, or our future, their past, and then from there went and settled the 12 colonies. And so the names just came from Earth, because humans are from Earth, and we've just expanded out into the solar or the galaxy, and now in this miniseries, they're going to go back to Earth, which is now, say, thousands of years in the future. And so I thought that all kind of stuck together. That's not what they decided to do with the show. And it doesn't make any sense. I don't know why they came up with these names, right? Because with their clear link to Earth history, if they weren't going to do anything with it, that was kind of weird.
I mean, it's a problem, right? Not just the names, but also the fact that these particular constellations are only visible from the Earth at a particular period in time.
Yes.
Both of which seem to not be consistent with where the series is located in time and space and all that.
This was actually my biggest science gripe with the show. I didn't want to bring it up because it happens much later on. But yeah, if they were seeing the constellations as they do on Earth and align with these different colonies, you should have to be, A, pretty close to Earth, both in space and time. And anyways, it turns out that they're not close to Earth in space and time. And so the constellations should look very different. So that was completely wrong and also made no sense with the finale they came up with. I really think somebody should have talked to Ron Moore about basic astronomy before he wrote that finale.
Well, there's only one word I can use to, you know, respond to that. And it's frack.
I do love frack. It's their backdoor way of swearing throughout the show, which is fun. And we can keep our podcast, kid friendly too, by we'll have to insert frack when we need to use a swear word.
That's pretty good, because we can definitely borrow some of those terms that get used throughout science fiction as ways of having some fun, I think.
Yeah.
Well, looking at the other things that we were thinking about in terms of the science shine, I think there's a whole bunch that kind of fit together, mm-hmm. thinking about how air moves around in various situations. Because I think, you know, the idea of having pressure suits and pressure doors, these are nice little details. We don't just MacGuffin it away with fields as it's done on some other shows. You know, we've got things like venting air to put out the fires. That was nice to see. And, you know, I like that high pressure decision, which reminds me really very strongly of like these, like a combination of space and these submarine movies where there's people trapped in a compartment that you need to, you know, vent to get rid of the fire. So I like that quite a bit.
Yeah, because a lot of these shows, like you'll have explosions on spaceships and it's like, wouldn't that just vent the whole spaceship and send everybody out into space? There's no obvious bulkheads. Whereas on the Battlestar Galactica, it seems like every door is basically a bulkhead. It's a pressure door. You could be safe within that location. So that seems more realistic for a Battlestar. Whereas the Enterprise, like you poke a tiny hole in it and the whole thing's going to vent and kill everybody on board, right? That doesn't seem super safe. So that looked pretty realistic to me.
I like that too. The one place that I did not love, although I think we might have some different opinions on this, is the explosions out in deep space. And I understand this is special effects. They look like they're fuel air explosions because they probably are, at least, you know, within the effects shop. But it's really interesting how going to a vacuum environment really changes some of these things. You know, you've got this lack of a shockwave essentially for small explosions because the concentration of gas in the vacuum is very low, effectively zero. So you're transporting the energy with that gas that was provided in the original explosion. And it works a little bit differently. You get a much greater expansion of things as well. And if to pull us back to the nuclear weapons, the Americans actually did do a few nuclear tests at very high altitude, which had very negative consequences because of that ability to really expand outwards and interfere with geomagnetic currents and things like that. So Project Starfish, for instance.
Yeah, I'll cede this one to you, John. I think I was used to seeing explosions in an atmosphere and neglected to think of what would happen in vacuum. So that's an excellent point, that maybe you wouldn't knock out a nearby Viper or Raptor with an explosion.
It is hard to be angry about it, though, because I think every series does this. It's just more spectacular that way. To give an example that our viewers might be familiar with, if you've ever seen the show Mythbusters, for instance, they'll often destroy things with high explosives. And there's a few episodes where they demonstrate the difference between gasoline mixtures with air and high explosives, where they're destroying a car or a cement truck or whatever. And with the gasoline ones, you see that big fireball and it's exciting and whatnot. Whereas with the high explosives, the car just simply ceases to be.
Yeah, that was the Cylon approach, right?
Indeed.
So yeah, speaking of which, because the Cylons kill everybody, the Secretary of Education famously becomes president of the colonies. And so I looked it up, and it turns out that the U.S. Secretary of Education, as a point of comparison, is 16th in line to the presidency, whereas Roslyn is 43rd in line to the presidency. So Adar must have had a much bigger cabinet than the U.S. president does.
Well, you know, that's why the Cylons needed to come in, you know, to cut through the bureaucracy.
That's right. That's right. Although one of my favorite scenes from this miniseries is that scene where she's getting inaugurated, and they did that on purpose. It's supposed to be a direct mimic of Lyndon B. Johnson getting inaugurated after Kennedy was killed in 1963 on Air Force One. I would encourage you to look up that picture because they did a good job, I think, trying to replicate that here.
It's a nice touch point, definitely. Well, with that, I think that is a fantastic segue into the of its time section. Let's take a minute, regroup, and we'll be right back with that particular chunk. Welcome back. This is the section of the program where we talk about what situates our particular show or movie in its time. And this one, I thought was quite interesting. It is very firmly situated in the post 9/11 era. And that might have, I think, been more obvious to you, Catherine, because you were watching it in real time as it came out, whereas I'm here watching it in 2025. So what were your impressions?
Well, I'm a bit dense sometimes, so I think some people had to point these parallels out to me. But once you start seeing them, they do seem quite obvious. It's a series about a war between humanity and the Cylons, right? And we were in the middle of a war at this time. So this was filmed in summer of 2003 and released in December of that year. The U.S. was pretty firmly entrenched in a war with Iraq at that point. And so that was definitely on people's minds. And so you see this a little bit in the miniseries, but they do some more direct parables later on in the series where they try to take the U.S. occupation of Iraq and turn it on its head. There, they would call the Iraqis the terrorists and the U.S. were the good guys. But in the parable they have in Battlestar Galactica, it's the opposite, right? Our heroes are essentially the terrorists. They're trying to fight back against a Cylon occupation. And so in this case, the Cylons would be the U.S. occupiers, right? And so makes you think, who's really the good guy? Who's really the bad guy? You know, and kind of re-examine the U.S.'s role in Interstellar. U.S.'s role in international affairs. Sorry, I said Interstellar instead of international.
No worries. I think that's the lovely thing about science fiction sometimes is that you can talk about these sorts of things in a way that isn't direct. You can do it with a parable or an allegory in such a way that you're still playing with the issues, but maybe not having the same principles in quite the same way. So it's neat.
Yeah, yeah. So I think this was the perfect show for the post 9/11 world. I don't know if that was related or not. It sounds like there had been several failed attempts to reboot this series prior to 2003. So maybe it was just a happy accident, but it was the right show to be put on around this time.
And of course, coming from 2003, it had to be shot in Vancouver.
It did. Yeah. It's so obvious it's from Vancouver, similar to the X-Files. It just really, it's another character in the show. And unlike the X-Files, they do stay in Vancouver the whole run of the series. So there's lots of fun locations to keep your eye out for. And in this miniseries, the most recognizable one is Simon Fraser University, which is one of the universities in the Vancouver area. Yeah. So that's where that street market takes place, where Six kills the baby. And she and Baltar are walking around chatting. There's also, how does Baltar have such a nice house? He must be getting some really good defense contracts. But he has this beautiful house on the ocean. And that's also a very Vancouver location that you can see. I was actually living in Vancouver when they were filming this. So I'm amazed I didn't see anybody. I guess it wasn't on my radar at that point, so I wasn't paying attention. But at least for the first year of the show, yeah, I was around Vancouver when they were filming. So, you know, it's very much in line with what I remember of what the place looked like in 2003 and 2004.
It definitely looks like there's less on location work with this one versus a show like The X-Files.
Right.
So you know, that could be part of it. Plus that that quad on the Simon Fraser campus. I have to wonder how many movies and TV shows it's in. I want to say that that played many, many roles in the X-Files.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I can think of a couple of scenes that they filmed there as well. There's just so many sci-fi shows filmed in Vancouver. I'm sure it's used quite a lot. They do film at UBC, too, where I got my degree. There's some pretty nice shots there, including the famous Chan Center, where I actually graduated, got my bachelor's degree. They filmed there and later in season one.
Well, don't worry, Catherine. I'm having the same kind of nostalgia now that the film universe has moved more to Toronto, and I'm seeing more things that I knew when I was in undergrad.
That's right. That's right. Well, it's fine. It's, you know, Vancouver is, I'm sure, very different now, 20 years later. So I'm happy to keep the Vancouver of my memory enshrined in these television shows.
So something else that's interesting, I think, for that period is you had some changes in terms of the way that gender was handled on television shows, especially in the late 90s and early 2000s. And we talked about this when we talked about Star Trek, how Star Trek was sort of a leader in this. You know, you went to the where no one has gone before, from no, where no man has gone before. But sadly, they did not get that memo in this particular show. It opens with this comment about how Cylons were created by man. At the same time, they do get some things quite right. I mean, they've got some strong female characters. And I think there's a particular turn of phrase that you like that they use throughout the series as well.
Yeah, they use sir for everybody. You know, it's not sir and ma'am. It's if you're in a position of power, you're there, sir, right? So it's gender neutral use of that term, which I thought was, you know, pretty evolved for 2003. As John mentioned, there's also some pretty strong female characters, one of whom is Starbuck, who was played by a man in the original series, the 1978 version. And she got a lot of backlash, both the show and the actress, for playing Starbuck as a woman, even though I think she did a bang-up job taking this very confident, swaggering Viper pilot and putting her own spin on it. But yeah, like people were mad that she was a woman and not a man, going so far that she got death threats. She was booed at the San Diego Comic-Con. And it's so bizarre because, you know, by the end of the series, I think most people really liked her character, thought she did a good job with Starbuck. So it just shows how misogynistic, I guess, people still were back in 2003.
I'm with you. She's one of the more interesting characters and more interesting interpretations of it in the miniseries, where it's difficult to really get much character development going on. And it's weird. You go back and you read some of that commentary now, and it just seems so, so tone deaf. There's even a commentary that I saw written by the actor who had played Starbuck on the original one. And oh my.
So out of touch. Yeah, not great. I guess Boomer was also a man in the original series, but I guess people cared less about that because she wasn't one of the main characters. I guess in the original series, Apollo and Starbuck were like the main characters, as opposed to this series where it's more of an ensemble cast, I would say.
It's true. It even maybe favors, at least the parts that I saw, the leadership. But maybe that's necessary for the miniseries where they're setting up so much of the plot.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the main character is Adama, right? Commander Adama, EJO.
Yeah.
So they pull out the big guns with Edward James Olmos playing that role, and he does a great job. Whereas I think in the original series, Adama was sort of in the background. You didn't see him much. But the other main character, Apollo, actually comes back. Richard Hatch played Apollo in the 1978 series. He was pushing to do a reboot or a sequel to Battlestar Galactica for a really long time. But he actually comes back and plays a different character in the 2003 version. And so he's on board. He does a great job and has some really cool scenes with the new Apollo, Jamie Bamber. So that's kind of cool to see.
Very good. So the other thing that I think I would bring up here is the drab colors. So there seemed to be this movement away from, you know, bright, colorful future. Like if you want to go and see just a riot of insanity, go and watch the original Star Trek, where every single wall is a different loud color. You eat food that looks to be made of dye. It's just insane. Whereas into the 80s, especially into the 90s and into the early 2000s, you saw more of this, you know, more realistic, gritty kind of drab colors. I mean, it looks almost like, you know, Vancouver is inside this spaceship a little to me in this one. So that, I think, does position it pretty well.
Well, I don't know. I feel like sci-fi took maybe some cues from Battlestar Galactica, because now everything has gotten darker. I've been watching Picard, you know, and as opposed to The Next Generation, when everything's super bright, well lit, everything's dark. I mean, maybe it's not as dirty as the Battlestar Galactica, but it's certainly as dark as the Battlestar Galactica now. I don't know. Yeah, it's like you can't be a cool, hip sci-fi show nowadays without having like dimmed lighting everywhere, which seems very impractical when you're trying to run a starship.
Definitely. Well, we'll have to do Picard at some point, because I've got to say the Federation does not come off very nice in that one.
No. Another thing that I think positions this more in 2003, though, is the smoking, right? And Starbuck very famously is smoking in that encounter she has with Ty during the card game. But yeah, there's quite a bit of smoking throughout the series. And I was like, how realistic is this? Are sailors actually allowed to smoke inside battleships, inside submarines? So I looked it up, and they actually didn't ban smoking on submarines until 2010. So this would have been fine for the time. Like, Starbuck could have taken her cigar and gone on a submarine and smoked it, which just blows my mind, right? That you could smoke on a enclosed submarine even as much as 15 years ago. Just crazy.
Yeah, that doesn't help with the filters very much.
I guess we had the same issue with the core, right? With Stanley Tucci.
Yes, that's right.
Smoking in another confined space. That also came out in 2003.
I think the other thing that I noticed in... I don't know. It struck me there's something about the haircuts that that feels very like early 2000s as well.
I can see that. Yeah. I mean, their hair does evolve over the course of the series. I guess with Katie Sackhoff, who plays Starbuck, they were worried that she looked too feminine when they hired her. So maybe that's why they gave her such a kind of a choppy short cut. Her hair does grow out over the course of the series. So it does change. I mean, mind you, the series, I think, ended in 2008. So it's a 5-year run. So things change. But yeah, I can see what you're talking about.
Yeah, and one thing that I think for me it does like firmly place it in that 5 years was that feels like it was the 5 years when suddenly TV became obsessed with webisodes. And so this one does have a few of those.
Yeah, no, it was really exciting when they came out. And I watched them. They're not good. I wouldn't necessarily recommend them.
Were any of the webisodes from any of these shows good?
But I was really excited when they came out because, you know, at the time, remember when TV had seasons and then like time periods between seasons when you had to wait? Nobody does that anymore, but it was kind of a nice way to bridge the gap between seasons to watch the webisodes. In another of the season's gap, they actually had a whole movie called Razor, which introduces a new character and a new plot point, which is really changes the series, which I thought was interesting. You might remember Michelle Forbes from Star Trek, Ensign Row. So she comes back and plays an admiral, a fleet admiral, and at least some really interesting confrontations there. And then later they had a spinoff series called Caprica. I didn't watch it much. I can't recall much of what happened on that show. It wasn't great, so I didn't pursue it further.
Well, before we go on, is there anything else you want to sort of highlight in this section?
I'll just highlight one thing I learned when I was reading up kind of on the background here. And that was they make a point of showing the number for the last passenger to get on the Raptor that's leaving Caprica. And her number was 47. And I didn't know this, but apparently 47 was used either outright or hidden in the background of almost every episode of Star Trek The Next Generation. And this is notable because Ron Moore wrote a lot of episodes for Star Trek The Next Generation. So maybe he picked that habit up from that show. And it's kind of a weird reference. It has something to do with Pomona College. Yeah, they have something with the number 47, which relates to another writer on The Next Generation, Joe Manosky. So I don't know. I just thought it was kind of an interesting fun fact that I wasn't aware of until I started reading up on this.
You see that in so many shows, like with The X-Files, what is it, 1121 that shows up?
Oh, yeah, 1121, 1013. Those ones are more obvious. 1013 is Chris Carter's birthday. 1121 is his wife's birthday. So there's certain numbers, but they all relate back to the people who work on the show. This 47 one seems a bit more oblique.
A stretch?
Yeah, bit more, yeah. I don't know. Maybe not if you're a graduate of Pomona College.
Oh, Pomona, not Pomona.
I don't know.
Apologies to everyone out there who went to Pomona or Pomona College. We've lost a chunk of our core audience now.
Yes, it's true. And one last fun fact, because I know there's a lot of nerds in the audience, or I hope so, and many of you probably have seen the show Firefly, which aired in 2002, so that was the year before this came out. And so that show ended, and they picked up the special effects people from Zoic Studios, who did Firefly. And so when, in one of the first scenes where Rosalind is getting the bad news about her breast cancer from the doctor, you can actually see a Firefly-class ship flying through the city, so a little fun Easter egg for those Firefly fans out there.
All right, we'll leave it there, and we'll come back with the ratings section after this.
All right, welcome back, everyone. So this is the part of the episode where we rank the television show in terms of its scientific accuracy, in terms of its influence, and in terms of how it holds up over time. This ranking is on a scale of 1 to 5. So let's start with the scientific accuracy. What did you give this show, John?
So I put this one right down the middle. I think there's a few things that it does quite well. The faster than light thing is nice to see. At least space is quieter than it is in other shows. But definitely some things that are not quite accurate. So I felt this one was like right down the middle with a 3.
Yeah, I gave it a little bit lower, 2.5. A lot of the science, they don't explain. You know, gravity, again, is not explained at all. And when I took a closer look at it than I did as just a fan, you know, a lot of things popped out that seemed rather unrealistic to me. So, but yeah, but with regards to certain things, how the spacecraft move, the idea of how you would might develop an artificial intelligence. I don't know. I thought there were some things that were really interesting, but I can't give it higher than a 2.5. How about its influence? I think here is where we really disagree.
Yeah, so I rank this one, you know, quite low as a 1.5. And partly, you know, maybe it's presumptuous for me to say, well, I had never heard of this, so therefore it can't have much influence. But at the same time, I mean, sci-fi, speculative fiction has been a big thing for me. And this one just did not register in my consciousness whatsoever. So I went out looking for other signifiers of this sort of stuff. And it looks like the 1978 version, you know, it did okay, but not spectacularly good. And it got canceled, you know, quite quickly. And then when it was on Sci-Fi, even though the miniseries did fairly well, about 4 million viewers, the last few seasons of it, it had fallen down to more to 1 to 2. So that is, even on Sci-Fi, a fairly low number. And this is not to say that there hasn't been critical praise. This is not to say that it has, you know, completely avoided notice. Apparently, George Lucas did his best to sue it into the ground, for instance. So, you know, people are aware of it, but it doesn't have that strong oomph for me. And maybe it's just I'm missing an entire vein of science fiction here, so I haven't seen the things that it has inspired either. But I'm going to have to stick with my 1.5 here.
So I'm obviously biased. I gave it a much higher influence because, like I said, this is one of my favorite television shows. So I gave it a 3.5. I do recognize what John is saying. It maybe didn't make a huge impact on society, but I would say that if you ask somebody about a Cylon, they'll know what you're talking about, right? It's sort of a synonym for artificial intelligence. So I think parts of Battlestar Galactica have invaded our consciousness a little bit, or the use of the term frack. Maybe not so much anymore, but at the time, I think that was pretty novel and people recognized that. So maybe I was just in my own little bubble at the time. But I mentioned Cylons at a spacecraft meeting just 2 days ago, and people seemed to know what I was talking about. So I think it has had some influence there. And I think it's becoming increasingly relevant, too, as we talk about AI and how computers work in our lives. A show like this is going to be very relevant to society. Okay, and then lastly, how does it hold up? So this, as I said, was filmed in 2003. That was 22 years ago. What grade did you give it here?
So again, I felt this one was right down the middle. I think it does hold up well. The effects, you know, look good. You can tell that they're of their era a little bit, but, you know, by and large, there's nothing, you know, too weird or too campy or whatnot. And they don't shy away from the big set pieces. You see that in some of the older shows where if something is difficult to film, they try to avert it in one way or another. So again, I think this one's right down the middle with a 3.
I was perhaps more impressed. I gave it a 4. For 2003 CGI, I thought it looked pretty good. And, you know, I'm always amazed when I rewatch the show, just how good it is on rewatch. It still really holds up very well. It looks almost like a documentary about a space battle in certain respects. So I think, you know, I'll always enjoy coming back to this and watching it. All right. Any last words? Any final thoughts, John?
No, I think I've said what I wanted to say on this one.
All right. Until next time, what do you hear, John?
Nothing but the rain.
So say we all.
Popcorn Science is hosted by Catherine Niche and John Moores, with Catherine taking the lead on pre-production, sourcing clips, and writing show notes, and John taking the lead on post-production and sound editing. Artwork for the show is provided by science illustrator Michelle Parsons, while Sean Nock handles web hosting and ensures that our conversations make their way to your favorite podcasting service.